construction of identity in contemporary pop culture and public space performances, and concentrates on how work by artists marked by accessibility and other bodily differences mobilize media. She's working on two books at the moment: Theatre, Social Media, and the Democratization of Spectatorship Design, and the Performativity of Print: Dark Play, Spectatorship, and Subversive Social Practice. So today she'll be presenting Keep Calm, It's Only a Social Experiment, Social Experiment, Pranks, Activism, and Performing Marginality for a Mainstream Audience. Could you please join me in offering a very warm welcome?
Thank you, and thanks everyone for coming along. As you probably guessed by Sarah positioning this prankish type of study last, it's a new one, so I'll be interested in any feedback you might have, because it's one of the things I've only been tackling for the last year or so. As we said earlier, we've been here all day, and there's actually some interesting, if not content connections, then connections with theorists who've already come up during the day. So I'll be particularly interested to hear from those folks who are tackling things with a similar kind of lens, if not the same kind of content area. So, social experiments, obviously an online practice and one that seems to be getting more prevalent, so one that has started to interest me. As I said, sing out if you can't hear me, because I can hear a fair bit of... I know that sometimes there's a competition between front and back. Okay, sure. All right, let's begin. A woman walks the streets of New York City. Smile, a male passerby says. Hey, what's up, girl? How are you doing? Another says. Somebody's acknowledging you for being beautiful. You should say thank you more. He continues, his voice betraying frustration at her failure to reply. Hey, baby. Hey, beautiful. How are you this morning? Other men say again and again as morning passes into afternoon and then into night. One man walks silently beside the woman for more than 5 minutes. Later, another walks alongside her. You don't want to talk, he says. We can't be friends or nothing. At the conclusion of this two-minute video, which you're seeing on the screen now, and it's called 10 Hours of Walking in New York City as a Woman, those who are watching are asked to donate to Hollaback, a charity that's working to end this kind of street harassment of women in public spaces and places. In the comment box below the video, when it's presented on YouTube, literally hundreds of posters debate the gender, racial and social politics that are coming up in this video, including the fact that it's edited to show quite a large number of men of colour commenting on the appearance of a white woman. While some sympathise with the woman's sense of discomfort, others, and a surprisingly large numbers of others, both male and female, or appearing to be that as much as you can tell by their handle on social media, so who really knows, a surprisingly large number say that if you're saying, hello, how are you, have a nice day, that's hardly street harassment, and saying that such harassment is hardly worth a charity's time when there's people who are being raped and murdered and beaten to death in other countries. Alongside the original video, other messages and other videos start to emerge. 10 hours working in New York City as a woman in a hijab. 10 hours of walking in New York City as a goth. 10 hours of walking in Hollywood as a man. And a proliferation of other ones. Some of them are serious attempts to show other social issues that the people are interested in. Some of them are clearly satirical. They're very clearly staged. And they're performing parodic stereotypes of gender or race or class or even just subcultural affiliations and things like that. This video, the comments on it in that comment box and the other videos that start to emerge in dialogue or discourse with it, they're what constitute what's coming to be known today as a social experiment. And that's the characteristically 21st century genre of socially engaged protest type performance that I want to talk about today. In this particular usage of the term social experiment no longer refers to the process by which social scientists test out policies or institutional practices on specific groups of people by means of a research trial where they gather data and analyse the results. Instead, it refers to a very particular kind of performance of the real in which an artist, an activist, a campaigner, an entertainer, or sometimes just a prankster performs a stigmatised identity in public space to test out how passerbys are going to respond. The responses are recorded and then they're shared on social media to draw out, demonstrate and advocate for or against particular responses to that person or particular situations. Together, these activities draw attention to issues and ideologies that impact on some people's lives as they try to negotiate public spaces and places or the public sphere more generally. Even the most cursory search of a social media site such as YouTube shows literally thousands of these so-called social experiments for public consumption today. One you might be familiar with, it's hard to tell which ones circulate in a given culture, so I guess the ones I've picked are ones that have circulated in my home culture in Australia. Not sure if they've circulated here as well, but they're very typical. And that one goes on from there, and you can probably put it down.
What are you doing?
I'm transgender.
What? No, you can't be in here.
This is a girl's bed, and I identify as a girl.
You're not. Do you hear yourself right now? You are not a woman.
And you can imagine how that one goes on. That's a fellow called Joey Salads, who is a prankster who does pretty much wall-to-wall those kind of experiments, as far as I can tell. Another one, which is about anti-Muslim sentiment, it's from the same people who produced the breastfeeding video in the UK. They're called Troll Station.
She looks like one of them ISIS people. What the hell? Hey, are you one of them? Are you one of them ISIS people that's been on the telly? And extremists. You look like one. Yeah, you look like one of them. What's in the bag? Well, I'm being honest. Why? Can I ask you a simple question? Why do you hide your bodies and your hairs and all that stuff? Well, she is.
Another one that's about anti-Muslim sentiment closer to home.
Seriously, see what she's wearing.
What's wrong with it?
How can she wear this outside? Like, don't you find this confronting?
It's fine.
I can't believe this. Why can't they just be Australian?
And one about bullying handicapped people. This one has a large amount of swearing, so be ready for a large amount of swearing.
What the fuck are you doing to us? What the fuck are you doing to us? And what the fuck are you doing to us? You're fucking doing to us! You're fucking doing to us! You're fucking doing to us! What the fuck are you doing to us? Where's your fucking winter? Don't fucking walk into my door! Fuck! I swear to God!
So, a variety of different types of social experiment, but all using similar strategies in relation to different themes. As you can tell by the fact that at least two of them are produced by the same people, some of these people are entertainers or pranksters or ally political activists. They're not necessarily people who occupy these social positions. What the examples show, though, is that these people who are interested in producing social experiments do typically engage with challenging, confronting or controversial social issues. They stage incidents of domestic violence, abduction, robbery, homelessness, breastfeeding, or more simply being in public space as a woman or as a transgender person or as a Muslim person or a disabled person or some other marginalised identity, to try and capture enlightened and or unenlightened responses to the person and the situation. The popularity of these sorts of social experiments today is the result of a range of symbolic, social and institutional changes, as well as technological changes that are happening in the 21st century. In one sense, in recent years, the people who are working on anti-sexism, anti-racism, anti-ableism campaigns have had some measure of success. Legally in some cases, socially in other cases, and have fought to make our society more aware of the ways in which every human encounter is in some way highlighting or embodying the ideologies that prevail in the society in which those humans encountering each other exist. They've highlighted the way in which social scripts that drive these encounters construct our identities as male or female, black or white, straight or gay, abled or disabled, and thus our access to power and privilege and, of course, a sense of personal safety in public spaces and places. They've forced at least some evolution in the social sphere and in social structures, in the sense that there are probably at least fewer people who are willing to accept a status quo in which they don't get access to opportunity in the 21st century. There's probably also now fewer people who are comfortable with being cast as the oppressor who denies opportunity to other people. Although in these debates, and we'll come back to this later in the talk today, there are people who are more interested in what they call reverse oppressions, rather controversial term, reverse oppressions, as all sorts of people's status starts to shift when we can question relations with people who are in the mainstream dominant culture and their others, and there's a kind of a differentiation or an equalisation. There is increased talk about reverse racism, reverse sexism and things like that, which will come out in some of these responses to these kind of practices. Now, in tandem with some of those social shifts, we have, of course, also had the emergence of social media technologies. And in some ways, the uptake and the increased popularity and prevalence of these kind of social experiments is hand in glove with the emergence of social media technologies, because they're there and they're accessible. And these are things like YouTube, Facebook, but really anything that offers a two-way interactive platform in an online public space by which people can communicate and perform protest or any number of other things they might want to perform to each other. So when we're talking about social media, the important thing about that is it allows anyone to broadcast out into the public these kind of experiments or anything else. Probably even more importantly, it allows anyone, or at least anyone with an internet connection, to be able to get involved in the debates that these kind of postings generate. So obviously that's not everyone, because not everyone has an internet connection. But the part of the world that does have internet connections, literally anyone can get on board and get involved in the online extension of the performance in some way or another. And so these practices unfold on platforms that are seen as collaborative, co-creative, democratic, allowing everyone to get involved in a way that a traditional newspaper or a film or a theatre stage didn't necessarily, because it was highly gatekept. And this is something that appeals to what we see as more active citizen consumers today, part of the emancipated spectatorship group that Jacques Rancière would talk about, who want to have their voice heard in an encounter, whether that's an everyday encounter or an encounter with art or an encounter with institutions. They want to be kind of an equal voice in the exchange. The fact that these experiments offer a cheap, easy, provocative way for campaigners to shed light on, test, confirm or challenge social roles and relationships makes them popular. They're cast as politicised performances of the real. However, the structure of these social experiments, focused on pranks, which are then shown on social media, with the hope of going viral, raises performative, political and ethical questions about what the producers are doing to achieve the desired political, entertainment or economic outcome from this kind of work. If we look at the pranks on which these kind of experiments are based, pranks in the broader sense of the term are practical jokes that are mischievous, if not downright malicious, sometimes in nature. They're designed to make people who are drawn into the prank stop, react to whatever's happening in the prank, and then laugh at their reaction, at the silliness of themselves or of another social player who's been drawn into and bound up in this particular prank. We tend to think of pranks as a modern phenomenon, but they've in fact been around, at least in Western culture, for many thousands of years. If we go back to stories about strange creatures, adventures people have had, abductions, possessions, which tended, you know, 1,000 years ago, they would have been about the devil incarnate or some strange creature that had been found. Today, they're often more about a different kind of edge of experience, about alien abductions and things like that. So there is a kind of a tradition that's there, that's ubiquitous throughout our culture. There's probably three main types of pranking traditions that these producers of social experiments are drawing on. The first is the tradition of pranks as a kind of a popular entertainment that plays out amongst families, friends, co-workers. These would include the relationship-building pranks that are popular in schools, from primary school-aged children all the way up, football teams, bucks and hens parties, love a good prank, as well as in certain workplaces, and even things like the drop bear tall tales that are told to citizens of other countries, in which New Zealanders feature prominently. There's the drop bear, it lives in the tree, it drops on you, it's like a vampire bear. And, of course, in the Australian prank version that's told to people from the Northern Hemisphere, they particularly like dropping on New Zealanders. And that's one that kind of the whole community plays it against other communities. In a way that is designed to bring them into, I guess, a relationship with Australian culture that's ultimately designed to be bonding. The second tradition of pranks is public entertainment that plays out on radio, on television, internet programs like your Prank Patrol and your Punked and your Scare Tactics, as well as in news segments, often on the 1st of April for an April Fool's Day joke in which they're adding an extra hour to the clock or, you know, telling some story that turns out not to be true for the news agent who's reporting to have, you know, this moment of ha-ha fundy bonding relationship with their audience out there who may or may not fall victim to the prank. And there's stories of TV, news, radio outlets doing that with high levels of success. There's a famous one about a British a TV program that did a story on a spaghetti tree and everyone rang up and wanted a spaghetti tree for their garden. But there's also ones that have gone terribly badly. So in an Australian context, the most famous gone badly one recently was ringing up the hospital where Kate Middleton was in hospital, and the nurse who answered the phone was the story goes, so embarrassed about having been fooled by the prank that she killed herself. And that led to huge episodes. The third tradition is the artistic and activist prank tradition that I guess is based in situationist artist work, guerrilla artist work, and most recently what we'd call culture jammers or hackers or hijackers of cultures who are interested in turning capitalism or other kind of ideological systems back on themselves. So this would include things like, this is an Adbusters image. Adbusters, Billboard Liberation Front and the Yes Men are probably the most famous producers of these things that parody or turn advertisements for some component of consumerist or capitalist culture to represent the bad side of it and show up the ideology underneath it. In this case, the barcodes have kind of become a prison. So it's turning something ever so slightly to draw attention to a political agenda that's anti-capitalism or anti-sexism or anti-ageism or anti-ableism or anti-racism in some way. And those three traditions, what they all do is something that Richard Schechner talks about in terms of dark play or subversive play. They're based on what he calls twice-behaved behaviour, in the sense that all of them take a real-life role or situation or scenario and replay it in a symbolic form. Sometimes that's a lightly symbolic form, sometimes that's a very heightened symbolic form. And that's another point that we'll come back to. The degree of height or the degree of metaphorization or exoticization or rendering extreme of the role that's being played out seems to differ in different kinds of social experiments. The reason for doing this twice-behaved behaviour or restoring the behaviour, according to Richard Schechner, is that it gives an opportunity to show that identities and roles and relationships are both changing and changeable, and to give the audience the opportunity to think about what they see, learn from it, decide if they agree or don't agree, if they want to challenge it or change it in future. So in this sense, pranks follow on from that tradition, and their dark play is often about taking agency back from an authority figure, antagonising an authority figure, lightly or more seriously, as you move from kind of children playing pranks on the teacher at school as a kind of light pullback from authority, whereas the you know, some of these more politicised groups that are turning advertisements, they've clearly got a much more serious agenda in play. So pranks, as I've said, are quite accessible and cheap to create, and simple versions of pranks can often work just as well as more extreme, elaborate millions of dollars spent on the prank. They play out in public spaces, shops, schools, restaurants, transport stations, homes, as well as over the phone or the internet, not in theatres, as a rule. They require pranksters to perform an act of trickery, mischief, deceit, but they don't need to display any particular performance skills. So they don't need a virtuosic performance ability. They just need the vernacular performance ability that we've got all of us as a result of kind of participating in culture. The success of a prank relies on the prankster's ability to at least momentarily fool the prankee into believing a fiction is a fact. It has to be based on a believable scenario, something the pranky can believe is actually happening or is actually true, at least for a short moment of time. It can be a best-case scenario, you've won the lottery. Or it can be a worst-case scenario, an important item has been lost, an accident has happened and someone's injured, or aliens have landed. Either way, it needs to be something that needs to be taken as real, at least for a little moment, and cause real fear or anxiety or worry or joy or whatever the emotion they're trying to provoke might be in the pranky, the person the prank is being played on. They're meant to play along until the trick is revealed, so their response can be represented back to the prankster, the witnesses to the prank, and to society at large. In this sense, a prank kind of has to blur the boundaries between dramatic performance and daily social self-performance to succeed. It has to create a moment of uncertainty in which the prankster's ability to be creative, clever, culturally astute, and the prankee's ability to be responding with a little bit of anger but not excessive anger, and to be witty in their response and accepted as a good sport and things like that, they're both on the line. This means pranks are fundamentally co-creative performance forms. They've always got at least three different kinds of players. It's hard to do three with a clicker in your hand. They've got the prankster, the prankee, and a witness. And the witness is always kind of reasonably important to the structure of the form. In popular and public entertainment traditions, which play out amongst family and friends and co-workers, and even a lot of the television and radio programs where you sign up to prank your co-workers, the people know each other. So the definition of success of that kind of performative activity is the change in social status or relations, or the social capital that accrues to being a good prankster or being a good sport when you're getting pranked. In the more artistic and kind of guerrilla versions of pranking traditions, the people don't know each other. So the definition of success is a little bit different. The definition of success is not so much with different status that accrues, it's more to do with did we change people's ideological perspective in one way or another. Pranks are often treated as non-serious play forms, but they do have real consequences, socially, politically, and ethically. They're designed to build bonds, to construct them, confirm them, or challenge them in a social group of one sort or another. It could be amongst people banding together against the authority of parents or employers or something like that. People being good sports to raise their social capital in their family or their friendship group or their football team or with their co-workers and employers. Or in the more political pranks, people creating bonds of affinity with the marginalised group, the people who are all women or all transgender people or all disabled people, and also bonds of association that bridge out to more dominant culture groups who start to understand the day-to-day realities experienced by the more marginalised group. In this sense, Brian Sutton-Smith says, like a lot of play forms, pranks are often seen as, or at least theorised as, a way of testing power relationships in society without having a fisticuffs kind of fight. Pranks can, if they're taken in a good spirit, generate stronger relations between family, friends, colleagues, members of a community. People can take a certain pride at belonging enough to the community to be the one who got pranked, to be the butt of the joke. And it can lead to kind of continual cycles of pranking going on again and again and again in particular communities. Pranks can, however, go too far. They can cause offence, they can cause pain, they can cause embarrassment, grief, as much as a good laugh or a good look at our common response to a social situation. The prankster might not have the right skill to pull off the prank. They might not have the right social position. Some social positions can get away with pranks more than others can get away with pranks. They might not have the right read on the spectators they want to pull into that co-creator, co-performer role to understand how they're going to react. They might think they're going to react one way, but actually they react a completely different way. Particularly when pranks are played out in groups where there are people of different gender identities or different racial identities who can read things really, really differently. The prankster might not know when they're crossing the line, pulling someone not just into a prank situation but into something that traumatises them in some way, whether because they're being mocked or because they're having their convictions or their behaviours questioned, or simply because it's reminiscent of something in their life so far that was a traumatic situation. And this means the prankster can be seen as a cheat or a scammer, a criminal. They can risk losing friends. But the prankies and the witnesses who are involved have also got a risk that they face, and that's the risk that they'll be thrown into a situation that's in some way traumatising to them. The potential problems with prankish social experiments came out pretty clearly in the 10 hours of walking in New York City as a woman. The protesters, the producers of this social experiment, clearly they were trying to highlight the problem of street harassment. In this case, though, as I mentioned at the outset, there were a few people who shared that concern, but they were very quickly outnumbered by those who felt the footage, in fact, highlighted the problem for men, and in particular black men, when they were cast as oppressors as a result of this kind of behaviour of, hey, how are you, baby, damn, you know. The strategy and the technology combined in this case to, yes, create a platform where everybody could be an active co-creator and change the way the kind of relationship unfolded, but it didn't necessarily go in the direction that the producers of the social experiment might have thought. It didn't see a huge groundswell of, yes, we should stop this kind of catcalling stuff in society. It actually almost was the inverse, and there were both men and women, or ostensibly both men and women, by their claims when they're posting comments or parody videos saying, oh, look, I've had this happen, and really it's just giving a compliment. Why are you so worried, love? Whether this lack of predictability in the way the performance unfolds is a problem for the producer of the social experiment depends on their motivation, I think. If we assume that these producers in this particular instance were looking to draw attention to the problem of sexism and relationships between agendas and advocate for change, the fact that some of the spectators in the online extension of this experiment performed problematic attitudes probably only amplified the effect. So here are some examples of things that people said in their responses to this video. And when they're talking about, you call this harassment, are you dumb and deaf? Listen, girl, smile doesn't cost a penny. Society has been pussified to the point that a normal dude can't even act on what comes naturally to us, approaching women without catching shit for it. In some ways, if you're a protester or a person who's experienced street harassment, this really kind of just makes your point, if it wasn't clear in the video. So for them, I'm not sure the unpredictability was that much of a problem. If, by contrast, the producers were a corporate group or a commercial group or even just a prankster looking to generate kind of clickbait comments to raise up their own capital and status and generate some money by aligning their brand with a social justice sentiment through, I guess, what's sometimes called social marketing, so that you know, the market group who is interested in social justice likes the alignment between this brand and this set of ideas, then it probably would be more a problem. Because the producers who are motivated more by that desire to build their brand status amongst consumers who appreciate the sentiment about social justice aims in the footage, their particular consumer group they were trying to target might not have taken this kind of response to it so readily. So the fact that these online players undermined the claims and the call to action at the close of the video and the call to donate to a charity at the end of the video might have hindered rather than helped their efforts to kind of gain traction for their set of ideas. Whether the unpredictability produces problems for the spectators is probably dependent on slightly different factors. If the experiment was witnessed by, say, a woman who's been traumatised by street harassment, it may have produced a feeling of vulnerability or threat. And the fact that so many people kind of kept re-performing the harassment in the online extension of the performance may have amplified the sense of threat or vulnerability or potential for trauma in the encounter. The problems also played out with Joey Salads and his dressing up as a transgender, as he unfortunately... As you can see, I've truncated the little crypts. He keeps calling it a transgender. He's got really weird language about it. What people didn't like about this fellow, he is not a person who is transgendered. He was donning that as a costume or a role for the sake of his social experiment. And that produced some feelings of trauma in the people who became witnesses to the prankster and the prankies encounter. I've never been so pissed. Please fucking educate yourself before trying to gain fame from the transgender community. If anything, you're hurting us by dehumanising us and fooling your younger viewers into thinking it's okay to say transgenders or a transgender. So that's clearly someone who feels quite offended at the least and possibly traumatised at the worst by this attempt at a kind of a prankish social experiment. The fellow who produced it, Joey Salads, did another one.
How do you feel about sharing a bedroom with a transgender woman? You don't have a problem? Did you even notice?
No.
You didn't even notice? All right, thanks.
Excuse me.
How did you feel about sharing a bedroom with someone who's transgender? Did you even notice that there was someone transgender in there? No?
So in this subsequent one, and that's his reaction to the really negative response to the first one, he's asked a transgender friend, as he keeps calling it, to take on the role of the person going into the bathroom, and he switched roles to interviewing the witnesses or the prankees afterwards. It drew slightly more measured commentary from the people who engaged with it, but for some it was still very much kind of traumatising because it was kind of this tiny, small representation. And I was thinking about it when we were talking about testimony earlier today. It's not testimony to the full story of occupying this identity position. It's one little moment that some man has donned as a costume. And so even though he's looking for positive reactions and is getting some and is editing them into the footage, for people who are actually occupying that identity position, there were some problems. So these social experiments raise questions as a result of their form, clearly, and also the fact that they're frequently formed by actors, pranksters, or political activists wanting to say something about a topic for solidarity or for self-promotion, as the case may be, not by people who occupy that identity position. The experiments do record people's prejudices or non-prejudices and retell the story, using them as examples of what spectators should or should not want to be. They can be subtle or, by contrast, very staged. I would put the Joey Salads in the very clearly staged category, I think. Interestingly, in my analysis today, the pranksters don't veer to very heightened forms of representation, very metaphoric forms of representation, very figurative forms. They can look staged, yes, and I think certainly... if we go back to this one, it's very clearly staged. I'm not sure how much reality believing was going on in the initial prankees and witnesses, but it's not actually trying to heighten it to the point of absurdity. It's not trying to make a metaphor. It's still trying to play it naturalistically. And this is something that the pranksters tend to do. As compared to others, this is a disabled comedian called Lawrence Clark, and he was so... He'd sit in public space with his cup of coffee and people would throw coins in because the presumption was, why else would he be in public space? And it annoyed him so much. He sat there with a bucket that said, pay my mortgage, kill the puppies, to see if people would still, you know what I mean? So he makes it more heightened and ridiculous because kill the puppies is kind of ridiculous. Or more figurative or imaginative or symbolic. So this is a parking protest that's been done in a lot of places around the world where people put wheelchairs in every single parking space to kind of give people a sense of that experience of not being able to access society at all because able-bodied people have parked there. So what you see in performances by people with disabilities, performances by people of colour, performances by women, is often this kind of heightening that you don't necessarily see it in the kind of pranksters as much in what I've seen to date. And that seems to be at least one of the things that's making different results or outcomes and making potentially kind of different issues for the society of people that's been pulled into these experiments, whether they're produced by people who occupy the identity position or people who are doing it for a different reason, as an ally or in an effort to self-promote, but are playing it more the naturalist way. So the unpredictable impact of these kind of things is why some people have called for them to be stopped and say, they would never get ethical clearance from the University of Otago. They should be left for the expert. People have said that. These are not the first people to do public space performance, protest performance, to get, you know, questions on the ethics and politics of what they do. there are clear performance traditions that kind of are, whether they're directly lineage to these kind of prank performances, they've certainly got affinities. One we talked about earlier today was Augusto Boal in his Invisible Theatre, where he gets on a train and plays out a scene of, you know, a woman being touched up to see how spectators will respond. Another being live and performance art that does similar kind of things. So you think of, there's a pair of disabled performers, they call themselves the Disabled Avant-Garde, DAG for their acronym. They dress up in their most stupid outfit and sing She's Got a Ticket to Die, and they try and get people to sign a petition to send this woman overseas to a country where euthanasia is allowed. You know, these kind of live and performance art traditions, they're clearly also, you know, if not a literal legacy for the people doing this stuff, then a conceptual legacy. Usually, when people theorise these kind of things, there's arguments and conflicts about their political potential and their ethics. The politics of these interventions, you know, in the immediate moment, they're not doing what Elizabeth Gross would call programmed approach to politics. Programmed being step-by-step linear. You know, we'll do this and then we'll do that and then we'll go on this teleology towards this desired outcome. They're not programmed like that. They're what she calls unprogrammed forms of protest. And the unprogrammed or non-programmed approach to political progress is one where an activist takes a chance that deviations or deterritorialisations, is, you know, when suddenly the flow of things is interrupted and you kind of stop and have to think about it a little bit more, that those will produce change of perception in the individual that will change how they act later on in society. Most of the kind of work that happens in public space is in that unprogrammed category, and it's asking the passers-by who become co-creators to be put on the spot, forced to improvise responses and potentially come up with new ways of responding to things beyond those that history and habit and memory and socially determined scripts provide for them. So there's two different modalities of change. One which is, here's our plan of action, let's do it. The other is, here's a weird situation, let's see how you react and if that tells us anything about relationships. In the last decade, theorists like Jacques Rancière, Nicolas Borio, Claire Bishop have argued about the way in which these performances achieve or fail to achieve an activist or political agenda. For advocates, these face-to-face encounters are useful because you are face-to-face. You cannot deny the fact that you are eyeballing a woman, a person of colour, a person with a disability, and that makes it more likely that you're going to stop and think about how you're acting. And if you're objectifying, you will know that you're objectifying someone who's a real person with real feelings who might really react by punching you or, you know, in some unpredictable way. For Borio and people like that, they think that that can prompt the individual change of perception that prompts changes in action down the line that eventually has a political effect. For someone like Bishop, she has doubts about whether individual changes can ever have enough political impact to become more than harmless and unthreatening to social and cultural stability. She argues that at a certain point, art has to hand over to other institutions if social change is to be achieved. It's not enough to keep producing activist art. So for her, we need to move beyond the provocative kind of unprogrammed account into more programmed policy-based institutional changes to have actual change, actual impact on a renegotiated social contract. These theories might not be enough, I think, to assess these social experiments. The reason being that in these social experiments, you've got this unprogrammed, unpredictable encounter in public space, but always already in this form, it has to be played out on social media where others can jump onto it. And always already, it's playing out on a logic that the desire is for it to go viral. And if it goes viral, it might get picked up on morning television. And if it gets picked up on morning television, what you can do is show the prank as it was played out in public space, the people who did the desired or the prejudiced response. You can get the person who did the response to come in. And certainly with that breastfeeding one I showed earlier, our morning program in Australia got the person who reacted really nicely to the breastfeeding and interviewed them. And that can start to produce more program change because that's the opportunity for the television program, the producer of the prank, and the person who did the correct response to the prank to start saying why they did it, what steps they think should happen in society. So in some ways, these social experiments, what's unique about them is that they blur the boundaries between programmed and unprogrammed approaches to politics. They're always both at once. There's this exchange in public space where anything could happen. Somebody could just keep on moving through and not even notice it. Somebody could notice it and just have that awkward giggle because they don't know what's going on. Somebody could notice it and get really violently upset. But it's always then posted for a more discussion-based, programmed approach where people can go, we need to do this, and we need to do this, and we need to do this. And in its successful form, it gets picked up by other media to continue that more programmed debate. Whether this means that these sorts of social experiments actually have advantages over other participatory protest-based performance forms is something that's still to be seen. What I'm looking at as I kind of come into the research at the moment is whether or not that's the case. And the answer I find myself being tempted to give at the moment is that it seems to depend and it seems to differ based on whether the person performing this kind of prankish social experiment is someone who actually occupies the identity position or someone who's more of a prankster or a campaigner who's a bit remote from that identity position. And it's to do with two things. First of all, the level of height. So the people who occupy the identity position, the artists, they tend to make it more of a heightened reality, more ridiculous, more exaggerated and extreme, so that it's more likely to make the prejudiced or negative response look stupid. They're also much more likely to engage in conversation with the producer of the negative response, the producer of the positive response, all of the witnesses. I guess coming out of community arts traditions or Boalian traditions or even live art, they get everyone involved in conversation. Whereas when you look at the pranksters, they play it more naturalistically, they don't make it so ridiculous, and the only one they involve in conversation, if anybody ever, is the people online who comment on it, and the one person who gets picked out as having the right response to come with them to the media interview on TV. They never actually engage with the people who did the negative or prejudiced response. They never find out if the reasons for that were to do with actual prejudice or something else. So I'm tempted at the moment, and I'm surprised by this, because I'm not normally a person who says only people who occupy the identity position can do it, because we've moved beyond that in a lot of our politics. But it feels like for the pranksters, they need to find some way to engage with the people who actually live the experiences they're playing out in order to not get rid of the risk, not get rid of the unpredictability, but to share it with both themselves and others in the encounter. So both are getting both the negative and the positive benefits of the risk-taking encounter. And to me, I think that would make it even more of a social experiment because, you know, you would have engagements between different people in different identity positions in the process as well as in the product, the performance itself. But as we come to a conclusion today, you guys might want to tell me. I don't know if I've got anybody who've used these experiments in the audience or anybody who creates them in the audience, but I'd certainly be interested to hear about your kind of read of them, if they've come across your radar, and what you think of the politics and ethics going on in them. Thank you. Yeah.